Hey, hope you're doing great out there. We have a really interesting presentation. This is presented by Sonia Bossinger from Arias Bossinger, and also with a special guest, CJ Miles from the Fair Housing Continuum. He has a lot of stories and his experience in dealing with complaints and discrimination is an issue that lots of people, lots of associations, lots of property managers, lots of board members have to deal with. And his unique stories are really, really eye-opening. Right now, there's not a lot of legislation. Seems to be the wild, wild west when it comes to dealing with animals and discrimination. And so his stories that are really firsthand experience could be very valuable to you and your board. And he's also a great resource, a great asset. He's going to be rejoining us again for a future event. So check out our Facebook page and check out our website, camp.net, for when that comes up. And in the meantime, please share. Let us know if you have any ideas or questions or comments. We'd love to address any issues you're facing in your association. Without further ado, Sonia Bossinger.
Tonight we're going to talk about that topic that you all as managers of the Condo or Homeowners Association get all the time. This unit owner wants to get a 50-pound dog as an emotional support animal. Our documents say that we only allow dogs up to 25 pounds. We're just going to prohibit it as a board. Is that okay?
No.
No. And what we're going to hear tonight, I'm going to go over the fair housing process and case law on it, and then I'm going to turn it over to CJ Miles, who works at the Fair Housing Continuum, who deals with all the complaints from those people who say the association discriminated against me by not allowing X, Y, and Z, and talk you through that process, because those real life stories are what makes this topic really interesting. How many of you read in the newspaper just the last couple days about the guy in, I believe it was Clearwater or St. Pete, that has the pet squirrel that's his emotional support animal? One, anybody else read about it? So he saved this pet squirrel during Hurricane Matthew. So it's been a little over a year. Found this squirrel, really done wonders for his psyche. And now the association said, whoa, 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 our pet restriction says you can only have cats and dogs. And the guy said, whoa, 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 this is my emotional support squirrel. I rely on this squirrel every day, so I should be able to carry it. So it'll be interesting to see this battle that ensues between this owner and that condominium association as to what occurs. Because if it's truly an emotional support animal, he's going to win and carry this squirrel because there is no restriction on the type of animal. I mean, we've seen animals down in South Florida that are emotional support animals that are miniature ponies, the Shetland ponies in the condominium association down in Miami-Dade County, where the horse goes up the elevator 30 stories and back down the elevator 30 stories. And that's emotionally supportive for that person. So what we're talking about today is the Fair Housing Act. There's the Federal Fair Housing Act, and then there's the Florida Act. And that is what's going to apply to our private housing, our condominium associations, our homeowners associations. We also hear about the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which does not apply to our condos and HOAs unless, in some capacity, we hold ourselves out to the public. And we're not going to go into all of that, but there are HOAs and condos that are under the premise of the ADA, so they have to follow those standards as well. But with fair housing, we actually have more strict standards and we have to allow those emotional support animals. And the old way of thinking was, well, if this animal is an emotional support animal, it has to be trained. That's not the case under fair housing. These animals do not require any sort of formal training or any sort of training whatsoever. They don't need to be certified. They don't need to provide any certificate that this animal has gone through anger management training or anything like that. The animal needs no certification. So how does the complaint process work? So if you, as an owner with a condominium, say, I want to have this 50-pound pit bull that's against the rules because the rules say no breeds that are of this type of nature, and it's going to usually list a pit bull. And if you're a dog lover, which I am, you know, there's an argument there. We won't go there today. But with regard to that, if you're an owner who has that pit bull and the restrictions say 25 pounds, you're going to argue, well, this is my emotional support animal. I rely on this animal to give me emotional support. Maybe I'm a vet. Maybe there's other circumstances that you are not going to see. Whereas with a service animal, if someone's blind and needs a seeing eye dog, we can all see that disability. But with an emotional support animal, that's not going to see it be a disability that you can actually see. So what would happen in this circumstance is I, as the owner of this dog, am claiming that's an emotional support animal. The documents for the condo association say no dogs over 25 pounds. I have a 50-pound pit bull. It's a vicious breed, according to the condo docs. And the condo says you must have the dog removed. And I say, well, no, I love Bella, my dog. I'm not getting rid of her. She's my left leg. She helps me. I have these issues that Bella's going to help. So what I do, I don't need to hire an attorney. I don't need to do anything except for contact the Florida Commission on Human Relations. And I file a complaint against this association. And these complaints go through CJ's office, and they work with those complaints and try to come to a resolution on either having the dog stay or some sort of agreement, or the association actually gets penalized. So what the Florida Commission on Human Relations, which is part of Fair Housing, they find reasonable cause to find out if a discriminatory act occurred. Because when you disallow, as an association, as a manager who's working with these associations, these emotional support animals, you're technically discriminating against that person's disability. So they can either have the Attorney General bring a court action in the name of the state of Florida on behalf of that particular person to enforce the Fair Housing Act to allow them to have the animal. They can seek an administrative hearing, or within 2 years from the decision, once the Florida Commission on Human Relations has made a decision, that owner can bring suit in federal court, or Fair Housing, through the Florida Commission on Human Relations, can bring their own lawsuit. So basically, as an owner, this isn't costing you anything. So this is where the disparity begins, when we all work with board members who say, no. We amended our documents, we have pet restrictions, we only allow two pets, they cannot be over 25 pounds, and you as a manager have to say, I understand that. But federal law, Florida federal law, is going to trump that ability to for you to deny that owner the ability to have that dog. So to be able to win, that owner must show they're disabled as defined by law. The housing provider, which in our case would be the condo or homeowners association, knew or should have known the disability. An accommodation or modification is necessary, meaning they would be able to have that animal to help them do their daily functions. And the requested accommodation or modification is refused by the association. And if that owner wins that case by proving those elements, which are not difficult to prove, they're entitled to damages, injunctive relief, or both from the association for that discrimination.
Well, Sonja, first, before you even get to the law part, can the association still ask for the letter from the qualified person that states that they have to have it because it remediates or whatever the condition this person has?
Yes, but a lot of people believe that this must be a doctor's note.
And no, I didn't say
that. No, I know you don't. But a lot of people believe that it has to be from a doctor. It actually could be from a third party that notifies the association of the disability, and it does not have to necessarily be from a medical doctor. We've seen them from chiropractors, from a neighbor that says, I see this person on a regular basis and they have post-traumatic stress disorder, this helps them alleviate. The number one thing that the association cannot do, they can request that letter, absolutely, or documentation with the nexus between what that emotional support animal does to alleviate the disability, but you cannot ask for what the disability specifically is. You're not entitled to the information of what disability that person has. So that accommodation, being able to have that animal, is what affords them the equal opportunity to use the condominium facilities, the homeowners association facilities, just like everyone else. Because in theory, and we all know there are going to be abuses of this procedure, in theory, that person cannot enjoy living within that association without that animal. That's what we have to remember. But there are people that are going to abuse this process. They're going to come in and they're not going to actually have any sort of disability whatsoever, but as soon as the association enforces the pet restriction against them, all of a sudden they come up with a doctor's note. And that's when you, as a manager, are going to go back to your board and sit down with counsel and analyze it to see if it's something worth fighting. If the association really believes that this person had no issue, no disability prior to getting this animal, and this is just a ruse, then it may be something worthwhile, but it is a difficult situation, and I'll let CJ talk about that in a little bit as to what they see in their office. So those service animals that we talked about under the ADA, those are the trained animals, and that's not what we're talking about with emotional support animals. Emotional support animals are to provide a therapeutic benefit to a person with a mental or a psychiatric disability, but they're not considered pets, which is why they don't meet the definition of any of your pet restrictions within the governing documents, because they're not a pet. They're just like a wheelchair. They're just like a crutch, and that's how we have to look at that. So some examples of what emotional support animals are used for is post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorder, depression, bipolar diagnosis. With training, they're not going to require any of that training, but some of the emotional support animals are trained. Some of them do have some specific training for a physical disability as well as the emotional support that they provide. Now, what's important is a lot of times you'll receive a note from someone that they want an emotional support animal, but they may not use the magic words, "I need a reasonable accommodation." Those letters that they send to you do not have to have any recipe of secret words to actually qualify as putting the association on notice that this is for an emotional support animal. So just be careful whenever you're receiving any sort of correspondence from an owner regarding an animal that they're using for emotional support. My best recommendation is work with the association's legal counsel, because that's likely to be an issue that's going to come up for the association.
Sonia.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding ESA versus service animals, when you say reasonable accommodation, does that mean that we have to allow that ESA dog into the pool area? Even though it's not a service animal, it's an emotional support animal?
Yes, but not in the pool. And CJ, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they have to be allowed in the pool area, but not in the physical pool.
That is correct.
The same like with the clubhouse. I mean, as far as where animals are not supposed to be allowed.
Correct. So what's really interesting when it comes to this topic is competing disabilities, so to speak. So you have someone who has an emotional support animal in your condominium association. They're in the elevator with their dog, with the other owner who has severe dog allergies and bought into this condominium association because of the fact that it's an animal-free condominium. So now you have competing disabilities because you have someone with such severe allergies, and we have seen opinions come down where one of them has to use a service elevator, and it's likely going to be the guy with the allergies versus the person with an emotional support animal, so that you can have that clear separation, but that does happen. Those sorts of cases are common. I mean, look at the guy with the squirrel. These are not things we can make up. This is real life, what people come up with, and things that you're dealing with on a daily basis. I'm sure all of you have interesting cases of these animals. One of the ones that I've had come up a lot are the pet restrictions that allow only two dogs or two cats. Now you have the person, I just heard this today, I did a legal update. They have two Bichons. They're getting a third Bichon. Documents say only two pets, cats or dogs. Well, the third one's an emotional support Bichon. I mean, these are the nuances that we're going to have to deal with. Does the association spend the time, energy, money, fighting and say, whoa, 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 what's the matter? Why couldn't your other two Bichons emotionally support you? Why does it take the third? There are cases where if you have a community with one dog, for example, that's an emotional support animal, toward the end of that dog's life, that person can get a second dog in violation of the documents because of the fact that that first dog is on the end of its life, and we can't have the person with an emotional support disability now lose a dog and not have a backup dog already ready to go. So I mean, these are the type of nuances, and we all laugh and think it's funny, but this happens.
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm just curious, why is there no burden of proof on the person that has a disability? Why does the rest of the inhabitants of the condo, why don't they have to prove the disability?
And how is your neighbor qualified?
Because they can, if they're willing to attest to the fact that you need this emotional support animal, that's how they qualify. If it were to go to the Florida Commission on Human Relations, they may get questioned to see if that's truly, in fact, if they believe.
So that's just starting.
Correct. And a lot of times what we find as attorneys, we'll have a doctor that saw this patient one time, okay, sure, I'll write you a note because you're here for your allergies that you need an emotional support animal, or you're here for your high blood pressure, we'll say you need an emotional support animal. And I've had boards that say, we're not accepting that. We want you to contact that doctor to see if they're willing to really go forward and say, yes, indeed, I've examined this person, I've looked at them, they absolutely need this animal. And a lot of times you never receive a peep from that medical provider. But the problem is they don't need a medical note. So they could have someone else provide similar documentation providing why they need the animal. So it's a very one side of the spectrum type of burden at this point. There are criminal penalties that went into play with the ADA when people are having fake service animals in the public arena, which hopefully will start to mirror image into this private sector as well, but for right now, it's not there.
So the question that I have is, so you have an association that because of their insurance company that they have for their general liability for common areas has said, but we don't want you to have this laundry list of aggressive breeds on site. And so the board has this policy against these breeds because that's going to change their premium or disqualify them for that particular underwriter or increase their money that they have to pay or something else. And somebody comes in with a pit bull that is an ESA, okay, they have somebody in the association, we actually had something similar to this happen, who had been attacked by that particular type of breed two or three times in the past, so is deathly afraid of this particular type of breed. And the owner would take the animal onto the elevator, take the animal off the leash, and watch this woman panic in the elevator going up six floors. Okay, now can the association do anything by virtue of saying, look, this breed increases our insurance premium, having them on site, and it increases our risk with this woman having a heart attack or a stroke in the elevator? Do they have any recourse to say, look, you can have the animal, but if you create a risk or you create an additional premium for us, can they go after the owner for that additional premium and the additional risk?
So I'm going to break the answer up. One thing we didn't talk about, emotional support animals cannot be aggressive. That doesn't mean they can't be of a breed that's considered aggressive by society.
I'm not saying it was aggressive. I'm simply saying it created an environment that this woman could have a collapse.
So an emotional support animal cannot be aggressive. So if you have a dog that the owner cannot control, they are vicious, they're biting people, nipping at people, attacking other dogs.
What about just yappers?
Yapping would be more in your nuisance provision. They still need to not annoy the rest of the neighborhood if you have that nuisance provision. But as far as being aggressive, that is not okay. That the association can move forward and say, fine, you need an emotional support animal, but it can't be this one because you have no control over this one. You're not cleaning up after this one. You still have to clean up after this pet, because I've had that instance too where they just take their emotional support animal out and they just let it go wherever and they don't clean up after it. They have to clean up after it. They also have to follow the Brevard County Municipal Code. I mean, we are required to leash our animals with at least a 6-foot leash. So just letting them off is not going to be something that's going to be allowed, on top of the fact that they cannot have an animal that's aggressive and causing harm to other owners. That is not allowed. That is something that the association could take action to have that dog removed, because now it's outside of the scope of an emotional support animal, because it's not a controlled animal. It's not something that that owner can obviously take care of to the point where it can control it.
So are you saying there's absolutely no dividing line anymore, where before in a service animal we could have that dividing line and say you've got to give a certification or to see that, you know, what type of service does this animal provide to you? Now with these emotional support animals, hell, anybody can have anything now.
Correct. And they don't need to provide any sort of certification for that animal because they're not service animals. These are emotional support animals. They don't need to have any sort of certification because we're under fair housing, not under the Americans with Disability Act. Now you have some of your condo tells, some of your associations that rent on a short-term basis that are going to be under the ADA. So for those service animals, they can still require those certifications, but not for the emotional support animals.
How likely would we be sued if we went after them to the finding committee for the nuisance, the barking, or the not cleaning up? How quickly would we be sued for that too, you know?
With those sorts of instances, documentation is so important. I've had associations that literally will take a recorder and record all hours of the night that that dog is barking. But that's what we're going to need to be able to prove, that this is beyond just a normal dog. This is to the point where it's a nuisance to all the neighbors. This is not fair to everyone else who lives here. And that's what you really need to prove. I mean, any nuisance that you're going to prove to begin with is difficult. You need to have that documentation, time, date stamp, recording, video, photo, anything that you can prove that way is really important.
We got a hand up over there.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but one reason that we don't see a lot of case law, meaning extensive case law from the appellate courts, is because it's a one-sided attorney's fees provision. So getting to your question, if you push it and somebody brings it to the state of Florida, you'll go through a process where there'll be kind of an internal review, and the local department could dismiss it, but if it goes to a lawsuit, even if you win, you're not going to get attorney's fees. So in Brevard County especially, where we don't have an abundance of 500 and 700 unit condominiums, that's a hard thing to swallow for an association to go up against the government, who has unlimited resources, knowing that even if they win, they're still going to have to pay all the attorney's fees.
Now, that doesn't mean you're paying the other side's attorney's fees. That's only if you lose, but just your own. Seth is absolutely right. It's not a two-way street with our normal HOA condo cases where we're used to, we'll win, we'll collect and recoup our attorney's fees. That's not the case with these type of cases, which is exactly why we're not seeing a lot of case law come out of it, because associations are afraid to fight. There are a couple cases. There was a 2009 case. It was the Hahn versus Shoreline Towers case. The association had a long-standing no-pet policy. The owner was aware of the policy at the time that they purchased their unit in 2004. In 2005, he urged the board to allow owners to be able to keep pets. He wanted a change in the policies, the rules and regulations of the condominium, to change it to allow them to keep the dog, one dog. Board said, no, we're not changing it, so he got a puppy. A year later, owner requested permission, so now he's had the puppy. A year later, requested permission saying, well, this is an emotional support animal. And it actually went through the Florida Commission on Human Relations, and they determined, and the board requested documentation of the medical provider that provided the opinion that he needed an emotional support animal, the nature of the impairment, how the pet was necessary to overcome the impairments, and whether there were any other corrective measures that would serve the same function. And so because of the board inquiring more, the owner filed a complaint with the Florida Commission on Human Relations. An investigator issued a finding of reasonable cause and believed a discriminatory act occurred. So because they found a discriminatory act, the owner was able, remember we talked about within 2 years, they can then file suit. And the court found the board was actually within its rights because of the timeline of what occurred. He didn't have an animal. He asked for the no pet policy to be reversed. The board said no, so then he got a puppy, and a year later asked for it to be an emotional support animal. But this was all based on the timeline of how he asked for it. Had he had moved into that condominium association with a pet and immediately said it was an emotional support animal, he would have won. The association would have no case because of the fact that he had that animal. So same thing when you start seeing owners on applications, if you have an association that has to approve potential buyers, potential tenants, these are the types of issues that are going to come up. If they have an emotional support animal, the association has to be really careful on denying that. If they just see, oh, this person has a pet, we have a no pet policy, deny, that says that it's an emotional support animal, we have to be careful and investigate it further. It said that the owner only had 2 appointments, each with a psychologist and a chiropractor, and the owner previously requested the dog rule variance. So that's where the decision came down from the court, because he only had 2 appointments and because he had requested that dog rule variance from the get-go. So what can an association request? So it's information that is necessary to verify that the person meets the Fair Housing Act's definition of a disability, has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, but you cannot ask for what that disability is. Depending on the circumstances, it can be provided by the owner himself, so he can provide his own note in certain circumstances, a medical professional, a reliable third party, like the neighbor we talked about, who knows about the disability, peer support group, or non-medical service agency. In most cases, the owner does not need to provide medical records about the nature of the disability, and the association should never ask about the nature of the disability. The association can also ask for information that describes the needed accommodation and information that shows the relationship between the person's disability and the need for the requested accommodation. So what we call that is the nexus between the disability and the accommodation, without actually asking for what the disability is. But how is this animal going to alleviate your disability is what we're asking for. So I'm going to turn it over to CJ Miles to give us some life stories. I'm sure he has plenty of squirrel type of stories or other interesting stories that he can share with us. And if you all have any questions for either of us, please feel free to ask. This makes it a lot more enjoyable for everybody, because I think we all have real life stories. So I'm
going to turn it over. Okay, thanks. Okay. I don't know much more than I can add than what Sonia has already said. We've been knowing each other for many years, and we just met tonight for the first time. So I know her, but I don't know her. And she ran into my wife at the a commissioner's meeting, yeah. And they talked, and my wife is the executive director of the Space Coast Center for Independent Living. And she said, oh, CJ can come do it. So my wife volunteered me to come here tonight. So, yeah, it's that honey do this thing, you know. So I said, okay, I'm going to do this, yeah. So
but
it's bottom told, exactly.
I call CJ with all of these types of crazy issues and say, hey, if this complaint
she does
across your desk, how would you rule?
She's been calling me for years, you know, so yeah, we have this relationship. So yeah, I don't know how much more I can add to what she says, because everything she says is in fact what it is, you know. I have stories about the accommodations that we have. You know, you all know what's protected under the Fair Housing Act, you know. It's a violation to discriminate against a person based on race, color, religion, national origin, gender, familial status, you know, the presence of children under the age of 18, and persons with disabilities. 90% of my cases, or probably higher, is persons with disabilities. And then probably 75% of those are reasonable accommodations, and probably 65 to 80% of those are animal issues. You know, every day I get an animal case, you know. I used to talk to, I had a presentation this morning I did with an apartment association, and I always told them about, you know, I have this issue every day with this the terrible P's, you know, pools, pets, and parking, you know. So I deal with that almost on a regular basis, you know. And sure enough, this morning, pools, pets, and parking came up, you know. So I had to talk about those issues. But, yeah, animals is a big, big issue. I mean, I get that every day. For I am not an attorney. Fortunately, I do work with law firms, the one in Washington, D.C., you know, John Relman. Relman and Dane, very good law firm that we work with. They work with the National Fair Housing Alliance, which I'm a member of. David Boddy, who is our president and CEO, is on the board of directors for the National Fair Housing Alliance. So we have a lot of contact. We have resources with the National Fair Housing Alliance. I work with, you know, Matthew Dietz down in South Florida. Matt Dietz is a very good disabilities attorney that I work with. I can't function without him. You know, Matt advises me on everything that I do when it comes to animals. In fact, in the 22 years that I've been doing fair housing, I've only been to court twice, you know, because we've always had the necessary information, I should say, or evidence, I should say, to resolve the complaint at its lowest level, you know. And that's what we try to do. We want to resolve the case before it gets to the Florida Commission or before it gets to HUD or before it gets to, you know, the fact that we have to file in federal court, you know. So we did have two cases that go to that went to trial. And one was two young blind females in Daytona that we thought would never go to court, you know. They were denied housing because of their disability. They were blind. They were college students, and the apartment complex did not think that they should be living in their apartment complex. And we thought we would be able to resolve that, but we couldn't, and we went to court and resolved it. I mean, the judge ruled in our favor. Well, the jury ruled in our favor. And we won on all counts, but when it came to damages, they didn't see it our way. So, like, we spent a lot of money on that case because HUD, most of our funding comes from HUD. And however, you cannot use federal dollars to take a case to federal court or any court, you know. So we have to use our own money. So we spent money going through depositions and all the other things, flying people back and forth all over the United States to come to depositions. At the end of the day, I mean, we spent $30,000 on this case, which is probably not a whole lot of money, but we're a nonprofit organization. We don't have a lot of money, you know. So we spent this money. The judge, I mean, it took 2 years to resolve this case, you know, to go to court and everything. At the end of the day, the judge awarded us $185. That's what we got for damages. And we were seeking damages for the two young ladies and in excess of $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, whatever, you know. The judge awarded them $2,500 apiece, you know. Now, our attorney, Matt, who requested his reasonable attorney's fees, he got it. In excess of $200,000, you know. But Matt's a very good person, you know, so he was able to share that with us. So, you know, so everything worked out fine, you know, and it did establish some case law in the state of Florida. And the second case that we went to trial with was a case that I had, which was an animal case. We had a service member that had lived in a condominium complex, and he had a pit bull, and he was diagnosed with PTSD, and the condo association requested documentation of his disability. He would provide that to them, and they wanted more and more and more. Finally, it got to the point where he just said, enough is enough. And he called me, and I started working with the condo association, but they weren't having any of that. So I sent it over to Matt. Matt took it to court and won the case, and it's a very good case. In fact, I used that case with the Hahn case, you know, and it's a very good case. To inform the association, this is what you can ask for, and this is what you cannot ask for. You know, medical. They wanted his entire medical history. You know, and they couldn't. You just can't ask for that. You know, and the first time I got a picture with this pit bull, I was at a conference, a HUD conference in Orlando once, and this pit bull is this big. I mean, his head is like this big. You know, and his first sight, he's intimidating, very intimidating. But I mean, just. The dog is so docile, he doesn't do anything, you know. And so, you know, it just shows, you know, that the dogs sometimes get a bad rep, you know, because, I mean, it's a dog, you know, and it depends on how the dog was trained as as far as being aggressive and not aggressive, you know, it's a dog, you know. And this was just a dog that was providing emotional support for this particular person and, you know, didn't do anything. So now someone had a question, I think it was you. I'm sorry, what's your name? I'm sorry.
Penny.
Penny, okay. You talked about the insurance company. And was it you that said?
I don't think so, but
okay. Oh, the insurance company. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. And we already met, so yeah. So here's the thing with insurance companies, what we do. If the insurance company is going to charge you or a higher premium because you have a pit bull on the grounds, you know, then our thing would be we would go after the insurance company, you know, because they should not be doing that, you know. So, you know, we look at it as, you know, this is, as Sonia said, you know, we treat the animal as if it is a wheelchair, a cane, or some type of other apparatus that a person might have. And we look at it, would the insurance company go after you if you have people in wheelchairs, you know? Or would they go after you if you have people in walkers, you know? Or if you have a seeing eye dog, which is the obvious, you know, service animal, you know, would they do that? No, they wouldn't do that, you know? So just because the dog is a pit bull does not mean they have the right to go after you. That's an accommodation that that person needs that animal, and they should not be raising premiums for that particular animal.
However,
yes, ma'am.
But in that same length, at one association, we have made the requirements in our rules. If you are going to have a dog on the top 10 dangerous list, that mm-hmm. you have a liability policy holding the association harmless. Can we legally ask for that? Because we put it in our rules. If you're going to have one of these, you're putting us out of it.
Not if it's an emotional support.
Yeah.
Not
emotional support.
No. I mean, as Sonia said, you know, I'm sorry. But you really have to think about it. I mean, how many of you have read in the papers or seen on the news where an emotional support animal has attacked a person? Okay. Okay. I have never, you know. Now, I've seen where Rottweilers have attacked persons, pit bulls have attacked persons, dogs of certain breeds have attacked persons. Well, Shih Tzus have attacked people. Chihuahua. I mean, of course, they do that, okay. But for the most part, animals, the emotional support, service animals, they're not going to, okay. Now, is it going to happen? It might happen. Yeah, I'm not going to say it's not going to happen, but it may happen, okay. And of course, you want to protect yourself and you protect the residents of your community. Obviously, you want to do that. But still, they're classified as emotional support animals. And I know Sonia talked about doctor's notes, you know. For me, I talk to many physicians, okay, because I know people try to take advantage of the system. And I know that some physicians will sign anything. I know that, you know. I can't control that, though, you know. So when I get a case, you know, I will call a physician and I will ask, I will tell them, you know, here's the situation. Okay, if you're willing to stand up in a court of law, raise your right hand, swear to tell the truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God, then I have no choice but to back you. If you're willing to do that. Now, just like Sonia said, I get physician that says, let me think about that one. They do. They really do, you know. Because they know they're not being truthful when they write that letter, because they know that they're not truthful, that that animal is what they're claiming it is, you know. So I have to deal with those issues. Now, I know some of them will write that. You know, I had a lady yesterday call me, and one of the things you didn't mention is, what do you do with multiple emotional support? I mean, this woman called me yesterday. She's got two of them, and I've had one with four. And I'm like, what does four do that one can't do? You know, that's the issue. I mean, educate me, because I don't know, you know? I mean, yes, sir. No, yeah. Yeah, so this lady yesterday, she calls me. First she called in the morning. My office is in the same office with my wife, okay? Yeah, we're in the same office. We're two different agencies, but we're in the same office. But so this woman called the Center for Independent Living, and she wanted help trying to get into a shelter. She said that she had been sexually abused by her roommate, her male roommate, and wanted to find a shelter to move in. But she needed a shelter that would accept animals, because she has two pets. That's how she said it. I have two pets, chihuahuas, the mother and the son, okay, and she refers to it as the mother and baby boy. I'm like, okay. So, you know, so, and they talk, you know, and they try to find her some type of somewhere to stay. They finally got in touch with a shelter, and the shelter says, yeah, we have a shelter. I mean, we have this shelter, and she could possibly come here if she qualifies for our program. However, she would have to put the dogs in a kennel. So after talking to them, then about 5 hours later, they put her in contact with me. Now, all of a sudden, these animals are not pets. That's the word she used in the morning. Now they're support animals, you know. So she probably did a little internet research to find out how she can do it. They do that, you know. And now, all of a sudden, they're emotional support animals, you know. And she, I have her on the phone, and she's telling me, you know, first thing she's mentioning to me, well, the ADA says this and the ADA, and I'm like, okay, that's time out. Because I do not have jurisdiction under the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, fair housing is residential property, you know, ADA commercial property, so I don't have jurisdiction there. So, you know, so I finally get her straight on that, and she's claiming that these are her emotional support animals. She went as far as to say, I cannot live without these animals, and my doctor has said that I will cut my wrist and kill myself if I don't have these animals with me. And I'm like, okay, you know, I mean, that's what I have to go through, you know. I know in my head that these are not emotional support animals. I know this, you know, but what am I gonna do, you know? And she tells me on the phone, oh, by the way, my doctor will write me a letter stating that. So all of a sudden, it comes up, my doctor will write me a letter, you know? And I'm like, okay, you know. So what happens if the doctor writes the letter? Okay, then you gotta make a decision. What, are you gonna fight it or what? Because she will probably file a complaint with Florida Commission and say that she's being discriminated against. And based on the letter that the doctor provides, you know, she will probably win her case. She will probably win, you know, regardless of when the doctor wrote the letter. You know, it's a problem, you know. Yes, sir.
So I have two questions. And they're both regarding when you mentioned that most cases are resolved in, I think, the what's the term you have for that meeting?
Conciliation meeting? Yeah, a conciliation.
Mm-hmm. And first question is, how much weight, and getting back to that, of course, most associations would like to see the conciliation meeting turn out to the Fair Housing Commission finding no cause that discrimination occurred.
Right.
And I'd like to know, in the conciliation meetings, how much weight does the Fair Housing Commission place in proof that this doctor has really never seen this supposed patient and may have only written this letter, seen them one time to write the letter, number one. And number two, what does the Fair Housing Commission like to see as far as facts from associations that support the proposition that this is just a ruse in order to keep it happening?
Okay, for us, for the fair housing continuum, when I say we try to resolve the cases, usually what it takes for me to resolve a case is a telephone call. Usually I'll call the manager or whomever, and we'll talk about the situation, and I'll explain to the person exactly what the Fair Housing Act says, and then what this person has presented to them. And I'll ask, you know, did the person request a reasonable accommodation in writing? Okay, who did the letter come from? Because for me, I always require the person to give me a letter from their physician. I know that they can provide a letter from a third party, but I never tell them that. You know, I don't want a letter from a neighbor. I don't want a letter from them. You know, I want a letter from their physician or their therapist or medical person. And they always, you know, present those, you know. But, you know, when it comes to proof, I can't. Resolving cases at that level, it's fairly easy, because usually the association or the management company will just kind of cave in and say, well, okay, you know. And that's what they do, you know. So I, you know, me just saying, okay, here's what the options are, and, you know, do you want to put yourself through that? Because, you know, they, it just goes through my office, and then it goes to the Florida Commission. Now, I'll tell you right now, the Florida Commission on Human Relations is the agency that is responsible to enforce the Fair Housing Act in the state of Florida. They are certified by HUD to do this. They have investigators there. I don't know. They have investigators that are pretty much regular people, okay? They're not trained specifically to do what they do. They're just regular people, you know? And how do I know this? I know this from working with them for many, 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 many years. In fact, I applied for the job, a job at the Florida Commissioner's office, and was hired to be the housing manager for the Florida Commission, meaning I would be over all the investigators. I had to turn it down due to an illness in my family, and I never was able to go and move to Tallahassee, so I turned it down. But I know what the commission does. I often disagree with the outcomes of investigations with the Florida Commission by results of that Hahn case. The Florida Commission got it wrong on that case. I read that case, and I use that case a lot. Those investigators at the Florida Commission, their job is to weigh all the evidence and ensure that they get it right. But most cases, they never get that far because it comes to a conciliation agreement where the association or the management company or whomever, they just give in. They just say, okay, we quit. We'll conciliate, you know? And usually in conciliation, there's usually going to be a small monetary claim that the complainant wants to get, you know, and they will probably get that, you know, not a large sum of money, but a little bit of money, and there will not be a record of cause or no cause. It'll just be documented as conciliated, you know, and therefore that's it. However, the Florida Commission does one thing. When I say they're not very good investigators, and I really mean that, they're really not that good, because over 95% of the cases that they investigate become no-cause cases, probably higher than that. And I think all of 2016, I think there was only one case that they found cause for out of the hundreds of cases that they received. Seriously, you know, I look at their record all the time to see what cases. Most cases I send to them are no cause cases, you know. They're very, very difficult to prove. Fair housing cases are very difficult to prove. We have a very difficult time proving cases, even though I think that most people that call our office have landlord-tenant cases. They're not fair housing cases, you know. However, they still have the right to file a complaint under fair housing with the Florida Commissioner's office. And for a lot of cases, I know when they go to the Florida Commission, there are going to be no cause because they're really not fair housing cases. And those that I do think that they have a chance of being a cause case, the Florida Commission just doesn't do a very good job of investigating those kinds of cases. And those are small. Housing discrimination is not what it used to be, you know. It used to be very overt scenarios, you know, where you see a person was denied housing because of their race, their color, their religion, because the housing provider said, I don't rent to blacks, I don't rent to Hispanics, I don't rent to whites, or whatever the case may be. But they don't do that anymore. It's very, very subtle, you know? And so it takes a lot of evidence to prove that they did this. You know, some people will come to us and say, I think I've been discriminated against because of my race, okay? So how can we go about proving that? We have a testing program. So our test coordinator, if a person comes and say, I've been discriminated against, I was denied housing because of my national origin, Hispanic. And so what our test coordinator does, she will bring in one of her Hispanic testers and a white tester and send both of them out to the property to see if, in fact, how the both of them are treated at different times of the day. and they will get the information that they need, write it all down, bring it back to Marilyn, and she will look at this on, you know, and say, okay, there's a difference here or there's no difference. And usually there's none. Both people were told that the rent was the same, the availability of housing is the same, and so forth, you know. So why do people bring these claims? We don't know, you know. They're frustrated for some reason. They couldn't get housing. Some of them have criminal backgrounds that will not let them in. Real quick, while I'm speaking of criminal backgrounds, do you all know the new HUD guidelines on criminal background?
Yeah.
Have you seen the new HUD's guidelines? Yeah. Got it. That's a whole nother issue there, you know. I talked about that this morning, with the group I was working with. So if you don't know, go to www.hud.gov, type in criminal background guidelines. Yeah, it's something that you're really going to have to take a look at, because it's not happening now. Not many people are filing complaints based on their criminal background, but it's going to happen. Okay. It will happen in the future. So it's not happening much right now, but it will, you know. Yes, ma'am.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're saying that most cases come to you, you reconcile or whatever. Okay. And the manager or the association just kind of bows down and says, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
However, because there's so many more ESA cases coming along, mm-hmm. and so many more people that are saying that this is an ESA dog, mm-hmm. and I have to have it,
yeah.
I think us as managers are getting to a point where we don't want to back down.
Yeah, you don't.
And that's a good thing. However, you're going to have to convince your legal to take the case, you know? And just like this gentleman said over here, is it worth it? I don't know. I can't say, you know? I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what the issues are for attorneys where you're not going to, you know, get, you know, be able to get your damages or what have you, you know? So I'm not sure,
I think you don't on contingency, but I think most attorneys, if you have a board that wants to fight, and I've had some that say, mm-hmm. you know what, we're not backing down. We know this is fake, this is made up, and they're going to fight it all the way through. And like TJ said, so many of them, when they're coming to the commission, are... Yeah. Not finding cause.
I think for
the most part, when you get people that are, especially when you get multiple animals, that's when you're really going to have to take a, or you get a person that comes to you and say, I have this certification, and you say, okay, where do you get this? First of all, you know, if it's an emotional support, you don't need certification, you know, and they go, the first thing they say, well, I went online and got it. That's a problem right there. You know, like the lady told me yesterday, she was saying, well, you know, I only make $600 and something a year. I can't afford to get my dog registered with the national registry. And I'm like, there is no national registry. You know? And that's what they think, you know. And she goes, well, that's what they told me. I'm like, who are they? Her friends. You know, somebody, you know. I got to pay $200 to get that, you know, to get the vest and get the things that's, you know, there is no such thing.
Is there any accountability to the physician? Like, say there's a pill mill doctor, now there's the emotional support doctor. Right. Everybody goes to him to get that letter. Is there any repercussion to a doctor? Is it a felony or anything for him to fraudulently write these letters? Or, you know, anything like that?
I mean, technically, if they're testifying in court and they're saying that they lied or didn't have, I mean, that could be something.
Right. Yeah.
I haven't seen any of that. Of course, if it's contested and the legal decides to take them to court, you know, it's going to take a lot of proof.
You get drawn into it, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's going to take a lot of, you know, but then a lot of law firms or attorneys just won't take it because, you know, is it really worth it? You know, so it's difficult. You know,
like blatant assault, and they could slap on the hand even if they wrote a letter.
Right.
Just like we would face if we had a minor infraction, they may consider that in the medical profession a minor infraction.
The
point that you brought up, Sonia, about the under the ADA. Now, if you falsify documentation or under the ADA, you know, you can be charged with a criminal under civil penalties and pay some kind of fine. You know, it's like a little slap on the wrist or what have you. You know, and you know, hopefully that will go to residential housing as well. You know, for fair housing. You know, but we're still waiting on that. You know, to happen because. you know, I know that people don't tell the truth all the time, but it's very difficult for me. My hands are tied because you get this letter from this doctor. This doctor is saying, yeah, this is their support animal. And I'm like, okay, if you're telling me this, then okay, then I have to go with it because I am not a doctor, you know? So I can't say, I think you're lying, you know? I just have to go with what they say. Now, if the housing provider says, we're gonna challenge this, you know, we're gonna take them to court, you know, we're gonna fight this, you know, then by all means, you know, if they think they can do that, then that's up to them. But it's very difficult for you. I get it, you know? It's very difficult, you know? Because this whole thing of emotional support.
Everybody thinks they're lying. They come in with that emotional support. The boards believe it. Everybody has this rouge. You know this is not true. They're just trying to get it in there.
Well, it makes you wonder where does it fall into what's good for the rules?
Yeah. Why not just toss them all out? Because you can't selectively enforce the rules. So
it's, well, now, just it, throw it them all brings out. Up another problem. And we actually experienced this a few years ago with a client that we had past tense. Okay. Mm-hmm. Where somebody had a service animal, not an ESA, a bona fide service animal, who was a tenant. The animal died. Because it's a service animal with specific training, she had a new animal assigned to her. And in the very first week, while they're still in that relationship bonding thing, the board members, even though we had told them reasonable accommodation, mm-hmm. leave these people alone, they decided they didn't like her, they didn't like the animal, they didn't like having her here, so they marshaled their posse to harass her.
Oh, that happens.
And lunge at the dog so that the dog, in its newfound situation, would growl and lunge back in thinking that it was protecting the person that it's serving.
Right.
Okay, and on that basis, they said, this is an aggressive animal, you have to get rid of this animal. And the woman ended up terminating her lease early. How many cases of that nature where you have somebody that's deliberately flouting the law in such a way that you really can't go after them?
Yeah. I have never had that. Never, ever. Yeah, I have never had that. I've never heard of that before. But I suspect that it happens, yeah. So, yeah, by all means, you know. You know, the whole issue of emotional support animals, companion animals, therapy animals may be a little bit in a different category, but, you know, it's here, we have to deal with it, you know, we do the best we can, you know. The best thing that you can do is ensure that you document, you know, very well, I mean, everything that happens with that person, you know, because sometimes the animal may get aggressive. I did go to bat for one woman that lives in a subsidized housing property in Melbourne, and she had a dog that was a little dog that was a little aggressive, and I went to bat for her because she tried, the dog got spooked a few times and kind of growled at a couple of people and lunged at one person. It's a little bitty dog, you know. So, you know, she came to me when they were gonna evict her in this particular community. And I mean, this woman was just about ready to fall over, you know. So I went to the housing provider and we talked, we met, and, you know, we laid down a set of rules that she was to follow. The dog was to go to the obedience school for a certain period of time. The dog would be muzzled for, you know, when it's out in the public. And a couple other things that we put in to, you know, for so much time that, you know. And she went through all that. She paid for the dog to go to obedience school. You know, she got him muzzled and muzzled the dog, you know. And but she just happened to be in this close quarter type of community, you know. And the housing provider said, yeah, we will go through as long as she follows those rules and the dog, you know, gets to the point where it's behaved, you know, in public, you know, with the rest of it, then we'll allow the dog. And she did that. And after about 6 months, everything was fine. And everything worked out fine, you know. And so, you know, sometimes you just got to work with them, you know. Now, would that have been the same thing if it was a pit bull or a Rottweiler? Probably not, you know. It just happened to be a little bitty dog, you know. So it wouldn't have done much damage, you know. In fact, the dog lunged at a person. The person happens to be a maintenance worker. And it was on video where the dog lunged. They just happened to be in the hallway coming out of an elevator, and they had it on tape. And she claimed that it didn't happen. Of course, that's what she told me. It didn't happen. And I seen the video. Oh, yeah, it happened. So, yeah, it happened, you know. So, but, you know, but working together with both parties, you know, we were able to come to a resolution where both parties, you know, came to an agreement. And she still, I mean, it's been 3 years now, and the dog and her are fine, you know. Yeah. Oh, I got some cards. I'll give you my card. Yeah, some, yeah. But, you know. But no, just, I'll tell you, you know, I am a fair housing advocate. I, you know, my job and my personal issue is as a person, I'm an advocate for people's rights under fair housing law, you know. However, I know that people are taking advantage of the law. I know that, you know, and it's very difficult. And I tell people when they call me, you know, I tell them straight up what I believe, what I think, you know. If they're not being truthful with me, I'll tell them, you know. Because when it comes to multiple animals, that's really an issue for me, you know. Now, I know that somebody mentioned it about the dog. If a dog gets to the point where it's up in age and it may pass in a year or so and the person's replaced the dog, I've had a couple of cases like that, you know. Okay, that happens, you know. Now, you know, okay, now we've replaced the dog. It's like getting another car, I guess, you know. You replace the dog and you could move on from there. But, you know, when you tell me you have four, you know, golden retrievers, you know, and they're all emotional support, I'm like, what does four do that one can't do? You know, that, I mean, explain that to me, you know. And I've had people, you know, I've had, there was a woman, a mother and a daughter right here in Cape Canaveral that came to a beachside property. And they had like three big dogs, really big dogs. Yeah, I think they were retrievers. And they tried to claim that they were some type of service or emotional support or something. And the housing provider, well, give me some documentation. And of course, she kept saying, you know, she tried to use, you can't ask me that, you know, I'm going to sue you. And, you know, when I hear those things, I know they're not what they are. And, you know, about, you know, so I told the housing provider, evict her and see what she does. And that's exactly what did. And she left, you know, because she knew, you know, she wasn't being truthful.
What about the guy whose service animal they take to the hospital for the patient? It's not his emotional support, but his emotional support for taking to the hospital.
Therapy
is that okay?
To have those? Therapy dog.
Yeah.
That's different.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I would think in that instance it's his pet.
Here's
it's an emotional support for other people.
Exactly.
Not
here, okay. Here's the thing with those, okay.
You have to be the person with the disability to have that animal in that housing. If that person comes to you, and if it's a therapy dog for someone else that he takes to the hospital, that's not his dog, it's therapy animal. So basically, it's a pet for him. So he would have to be have to be charged pet fee deposits and all the other things because he is not the person with the disability as defined by the Fair Housing Act. It's for someone else. You know?
Because he'll just say it's an ESA.
That's what we're saying. She's right. It's increasing because people are knowing, oh, if you can't use words, just...
And that's, yeah, it's true, you know. The problem is not as much as it is the individual making the claim, it's the physicians writing the letters for them. That's the bigger problem that we have, and we know that that's happening. And they need to be held more accountable. You're absolutely right. So, you know, that's very difficult because if you don't have anyone that will fight them, you know, then what you have nothing, you know. So, you know, my agency cannot, you know, that's not what we do, you know. We don't, you know, we assist people to help, you know, file complaints and resolve complaints and so forth and so on. But I still, you know, I tell housing providers, you know, when I go out and talk to people, you know, oftentimes people look at me, well, you're one of them. I'm on everybody's side, you know. I'm not against anybody. I don't need this business of filing suit against people, you know. I don't need it. They just come to me, you know, because I know even in 2017 people discriminate. You know, I know that, you know. And I think about all of the places in, you know, I'm in this little jurisdiction here in Brevard County and all the counties that touch Brevard and work fair housing in this area. And I think about Florida is a huge state, you know. I go around Florida and do training to areas that do not have fair housing. And, you know, fair housing doesn't mean anything to them, you know, because there's no nobody overseeing what they do. You know, you think about, you know, the panhandle of Florida. There's not one fair housing agency in the whole. It takes 8 hours. Well, I don't know how long it takes to get from Tallahassee to Louisiana. However, it's a long drive. You know, it's a big area. There's no fair housing up there.
Well,
you know.
This is my last question.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's okay. Go ahead. Dade County,
Dade
no.
County, everybody wants to have a pit bull. I'm sorry. They ever said Dade County would be
headed,
but they wouldn't want
pit bulls.
They.
And
that
would
be that in a
discriminatory
way.
They outlawed pit bulls years ago.
Yeah. But how would they deal with this emotional support? Then they wouldn't get them in there.
Because the city's not a private housing provider.
Oh, so the next question that I have, can you give us, CJ, some kind of layman's litmus test for what reasonable accommodation is? I mean, what would be, from a manager's point of view, when we're coaching our boards, because we don't advise them, we don't counsel them, because we're not attorneys.
Right.
We coach our boards. We say, okay, this is what we've seen in the past. Putt, putt. Okay?
kind of thing.
So if we were to use a litmus test and say, yeah, that sounds reasonable. You don't want to bounce that over to your attorney. Just do it. On the other hand, that's unreasonable. Yeah, you probably want to bounce that over to your attorney and have them review it. Can you give us a general idea of what that reasonable accommodation might entail?
I'm trying to think off my head. There's a definition for reasonableness under the Fair Housing Act. I'm trying to find that, and I talked about this morning.
Than your brochure?
No, it's not in that. In fact, I'll go ask those. Good. HUD's definition states something like, it's unreasonable if the request poses an undue administrative and or financial burden to the housing provider, something. Which is kind of broad, okay? Yeah, really.
That's why I asked for a litmus test.
So for the most part, you know, it's going to be very difficult in most cases for the housing provider to show that the request was unreasonable, especially when it comes to something of that nature.
Okay, so let me throw out a couple of scenarios and let you give me an idea. This would be a better idea. Okay, so you have a condominium that has a lobby that has a keypad entry.
Okay.
All of us have those, keypad or keyed entry. But the disabled individual with a service animal, ESA, whatever, says, I need a reasonable accommodation of a handicap button to open the lobby door, because if I'm not able to punch the numbers, my dog needs to be able to hit that with its nose.
Okay.
Is that a reasonable accommodation? Because that's a lot of money and expense, and it also means that anybody who can hit that button can get in.
Okay. All right. So what are you so, all right. So
yeah,
wait a minute.
A whole other topic in and of itself, talking about reasonable accommodations generally. We're going to do a presentation on that in 2018 to talk about that, because I think that's going to veer us into a whole different topic. But generally speaking, in most of those cases, when an owner needs a reasonable accommodation to be able to use the facilities, Fair Housing, the Florida Commission on Human Relations, will allow the association to charge that owner for that amount because of the administrative expenses that would be on the association.
That was going to be my first question. Who do you think has to pay for that?
Well, that was the question.
Yeah.
And
so,
a lot of times
that's the answer.
Find when you come back to the owner and say, okay, we'll grant you the reasonable accommodation, but you are going to have to pay for it, because I'll run that past CJ and see if he agrees first.
Right.
Then all of a sudden they say, oh, actually, I don't need it.
Exactly.
I don't need it.
The big issue is who's responsible to pay for it, you know? And then, you know, is just the request itself reasonable or unreasonable? Because all the association's responsibility is to allow the modification to be made, you know? And then if they come back and say, well, we don't want it because of this, this, and this, and this, but the person requesting is going to pay for it, you know? So how do we get around anything, you know, that's going to cause something to be unsecure and those kind of things. But for the most part, the requester has to pay for the modification.
That's what
and that's a reasonable modification.
We had a homeowner that wanted us to level his backyard because he was handicapped with his handicapped dog. And I asked him, and Tommy said, just send him a letter saying that if he wants it done, he has to pay for it.
And maybe, yeah, and maybe have to, yeah, you may, the person may have to put the modification back, yeah, may have to, we could talk about, that's a whole nother story, we could talk about that next year, have to put it back to its original configuration once they make the modification, and then you can record, and you can require them to have the funds put into an interest-bearing or a non-interest-bearing escrow account for the, to ensure that they have the funds. We have had those, you know, where a person would say that, yeah, this animal is my service animal, and then this animal, it's, sir. Oh, yeah, I'm serious. We have had those. Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Have you guys seen the case? I think it's in North Florida with the gator. Yeah, yeah. You guys seen the case with the service animal? I mean, emotional support animal, a gator? Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's one that's up there. Yeah, I think the alligator was the son's gator, and the son, I think, maybe passed away or something, and the woman wanted to keep the gator because, yeah, that's a case that I didn't hear the end of that case, you know. And then there was one with the little boy up in Flagler County that had that's autistic and needed the chickens, and the city had to, yeah. That's a very easy, that one was very easy, you know. Actually, Mark Nations was the attorney that handled that case. I called them to try to help them work on that case. That was a fairly simple case because, you know, the chickens, okay. You know, it's like, what, you know. So anyway, but yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Require your dog be with you if it's your emotional support animal.
Yes.
I mean, people are going to work and leaving these dogs barking for 11 hours a day.
Yeah.
And yet saying that it's there.
Or go on vacation and leave the dog there.
Okay, wait a minute. Now, first, the first key that you said,
the dog barking for 11 hours, it's a nuisance.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay, you document it, you record them, you get rid of them.
Okay,
you remember what Sonia said? The dog still has to comply. You have noise ordinance, rules and regulations. You know, if they violate those and it's a continuing violation and they haven't complied with the, you know, your request to cure, you know, you evict them.
Have that dog with you if it's your emotional support. So that is a reasonable thing to
ask the person. That's reasonable.
Yeah,
they're claiming it's an emotional support. They need to have the animal with them.
Yes. To tack on to that, something Angela said, kind of, that when you said a lot of associations just capitulate and don't even talk to their attorney about it, I think that's a mistake. And something you said, too, that when I get these requests, I immediately, you know, assuming we get some paperwork from a health professional, I immediately, and recognizing they don't have to sign anything, I immediately go to them with a settlement agreement outlining all this stuff. This is my original, this is my reasonable accommodation. The animal's name is this. The name of the veterinarian is this. The phone number of the veterinarian is this. I promise, I agree they won't cause a nuisance. I agree they won't be vicious. And that, I think, serves two purposes. It, one, forces them to have a little bit of a come to Jesus moment that says they're signing their name to this, and
like
this
that
better be real.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Two, it protects the association from selective enforcement, and it addresses the problem you just mentioned without having to fall back on the condo docs, which I think, you know, that's an easy case already, I mean, but,
right.
But I think, and you know, most of the time, the owners will sign that.
Well, in Seth, to that, we have one client in Cocoa Beach that actually went to Taylor and Carl's before it became part of Pecker and Polyatica, and had them draw up a document and asked them to put together a registration form for ESAs and service animals not because they wanted to limit them, but because they were concerned that because they have a 40-pound weight limit, that they have condo commandos who would approach them in the breezeways or in the common areas and say, your dog is overweight, you need to get rid of that dog. And they wanted to be able for the board to know, there's a dog, this is the dog, this is the dog's picture, this is the dog's license, and they have their shots and they're registered with the association as an ESA, and so we let it be known to the community that if you question whether a dog should be on the site because they look like or act like they're outside the government documents, you can talk to the board or management, because we've asked all those people, no, they're not required to, but we do ask them for their own sake to register the dogs with us. We don't ask them for a lot, just the picture of the dog and some reasonable reason why they're an ESA or a service animal, so that we can justify to such and such that instead of a 40-pound dog, you've got a 120-pound dog. And yes, this is a dog that we know about. It's a service animal or an ESA. Leave it alone. And leave the people that are touching it alone.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say before we close up shop is if you have a board that has at least one board member who's loudmouth, that's going to talk to people in the elevators and yell at them and say, you don't look disabled to me, because I've had that case where the Board of Commission on Human Relations files a complaint for discriminatory behavior by one board member, and the association was held liable because of that one statement for discriminatory action. Saying that because these are the disabilities you cannot see. You're not going to be able to see them. So if you have those boards with that one member or those multiple members that are bound to make those comments, have a sit down with you and legal counsel where you can have it closed door, call it potential litigation meeting, and have your attorney educate them and say, this is what you can be held liable for, so let's make sure we have our ducks in a row. I know you believe this is a fake service animal. I get that, but they've provided us enough documentation that you're going to have to move past it, or you can still get the association held liable for these actions. So just, if you have those, have a sit down. I feel like 80% of my job, I'm sure Seth feels the same way, we have turned into therapists/psychologists for a lot of the board members. I'm sure you all see it. We are talking people off the ledge almost daily, I would say. So we're happy to do that at any point. But please take advantage of your counsel. Have those meetings so you don't get your boards in trouble. And I thank you so much, CJ, for coming.
It's always interesting to hear stories directly from people who have to deal with them. We want to hear your stories, your feedback, your questions. Send us an email, flinsuranceresource@gmail.com, or give me a call, 321-775-5514. If you have any questions, any ideas, shoot them our way, and we'll see you at our next event.